Hi, you're listening to The Sociology Show, a podcast about absolutely anything to do with the wonderful world of sociology. Whether you're a teacher, a lecturer, a student, or just taking a passing interest, this podcast will look at a range of issues from social class, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, religion, crime, education, and anything else that sociology has to offer. My name is Matthew Wilkin, and each episode I will speak to someone working in the field of sociology and let them explain all about their own interests, their research, and their experiences. So, put your earphones in, turn the volume up, and let's be sociology geeks together, eh? Hello and welcome to the Sociology Show podcast. My guest for this episode is Professor Frank Ferretti. Professor Frank Ferretti talked to me about his book, Paranoid Parenting, which is really, really useful for families and households if you're studying that at either GCSE or A-level. And he also talked about his more recent book, How Fear Works, which is really useful for a whole range of different topics, from crime to globalization and all in between. So without further ado, let's go over to the interview with Professor Frank Ferretti. Hi, thank you very much for coming on the show. Would you like to start by telling us a little bit about who you are and what you do, please?
Well, my name is Frank Ferretti. I'm a sociologist and an author. And I spent a long period of my life researching and dealing with sociological issues. I got into it by accident. It wasn't something I intended to do, because initially I did my PhD in African studies in the 1970s. But then I became increasingly interested in issues to do with my own society rather than something that existed far away. And in particular, I became interested in the question of fear and risk, and was really excited to have the opportunity to explore the way that fear impacted on our lives, and the way that a lot of our everyday concerns were being increasingly framed through an inflated sense of fear and anxiety. So that's really how I kind of began to do my more serious sociological work. And I published a book called Culture of Fear in 1997, which then provided the starting point for a lot of my other work, a lot of my other research in the subsequent 20 years.
Thank you. And one of those areas of fear, which we're going to talk about today, is the issue of parenthood and childhood. And you wrote a book, was it 2002, Paranoid Parenting? Is it around that period?
Yeah, around then, 2001, I think, but I'm not 100% sure, yeah.
Yeah, and the full title, Paranoid Parenting, Why Ignoring the Experts May Be Best for Your Child. So would you like to give us a little bit of an introduction into what your motivation was for the book, and also what your sort of main findings are?
Well, what happened was that I became a father late in life, and I noticed that the way that children were regarded, babies were regarded, was very different than I had anticipated. And in particular, I noticed that there was a kind of a climate of fear in the bringing up of kids, and virtually every child with experience went with a health warning. And that was something that really concerned me, because it also meant that parents became, to a considerable extent, disoriented by the fact that they had to continually look after and watch their children 24 hours a day. And therefore, I felt that in particular, children's capacity to have an independent life without adults supervising them was being undermined. So my commitment to the freedom of children to basically have the space to grow up without being micromanaged was something that motivated me to write the book. And in the course of doing that, I think I found out to my surprise that parenting, or child rearing, which historically has been seen as an accomplishment of a relationship, something that you do as a relationship with your child, was increasingly being redefined as a skill. So you have this term which never existed in the past called parenting skill. And not only was it redefined as a skill, but parents were told that they were amateurs who lacked these skills, and therefore they had to find experts who apparently had this sophisticated understanding how to bring up a kid. And this, I think, kind of created a dependency or attempt to create a dependency of parents on experts, which further undermined the confidence of parents. And I felt that what I call paranoid parenting was really the product of these kinds of wider societal pressures, where the problems facing children were being continually inflated. And because they were being continually inflated, parents were, you know, in a sense, put on the defensive. Mm-hmm. But then in addition to that, parents' capacity to bring kids up was being continually questioned.
And do you think that sort of overcautiousness, overprotectiveness, is there a moment in time where you think it really sort of, there was a tipping point where that really became apparent?
I think it very much kicked in the late 70s. Mm. And there's a lot of evidence that shows that the amount of time that children spend on their own outdoors begins to diminish. The amount of time that moms and dads spend with their kids increases from the late 70s onwards. And I think it's interesting that as you kind of look at the world in the subsequent 50 years, it gets worse and worse all the time. So that every generation of parents is probably less confident than the one that preceded it. Mm-hmm. And every generation of parents feels constrained to spend more time with their kids than the ones before. So you have a situation, just to give you an example, that in the 1970s, a mother who wasn't working in the 1970s spent less time with their kids, than what would happen kind of subsequently. And what's happening increasingly is that there's less and less ability on the part of children to explore the outdoors and have that kind of freedoms. And kids therefore become increasingly focused and chained, digitally chained to their digital bedrooms.
I mean, it sort of goes hand in hand with the argument. A lot of people would say that that protectiveness is evidence of a more child-centered, more caring society. Where does that sort of argument fit in with you? Because that would suggest it's actually gone the other way.
Yeah, I think there's a fundamental flaw in the argument that we become more child-centered and more sensitive, because it's not children who are demanding to be continually supervised by their parents. There isn't like a massive movement on the part of young kids to say, we don't want to, you know, explore the outdoors, we don't want to be on our own. It's the adult world that has decided that it doesn't trust children to make their way and develop independently. And it's the adult world that decides that the world is so dangerous and so threatening that kids need to be insulated from being exposed to everyday life. And although this is often called child-centered, I think it's very much adult-centered. It's a result of adult obsessions, which are being recycled through children.
It must be really difficult, Frank, to piece together the disconnect between the threat that the media is telling us is out there for children in a whole manner of ways, from paedophilia to, you know, online abuse, bullying, whatever it is, and the reality. Is the reality of threat actually much smaller than the media would have us believe?
I think it is, but we have to remember that if we're told that something is dangerous and threatening, then we will perceive it as dangerous and threatening. And therefore, our capacity to manage uncertainty, to manage risks, diminishes. And one of the things that I have found was that and it's not just the media, it's the entire parenting industry, it's very much the kind of cultural institutions that we inhabit. If they continually tell the world that, for example, putting pressure on children in schools, having exams in schools, makes them ill and they're going to be traumatized and they're going to become unable to cope with life as a result of that, which is a relatively new development because there's been exams around for a very, very long time, for centuries. Then what will happen is that people will internalize, children will internalize the idea that exams are really scary, that exams are going to make you ill. I remember talking to my wife, who's roughly my age, a bit younger, and she tells me that when she did her GCSE exams back in the days, she was hardly even aware of the fact that these exams were consequential. She was hardly aware of the fact that this was a make or break moment in her life. She certainly Yeah, didn't have anything more than the normal anxieties that you have when you're at an exam. Used to call that having butterflies in your stomach, and certainly nobody was traumatized by it. Whereas today, if you've been told that this is going to have a big psychological impact on your life, this is very, potentially quite threatening. That after a while, that narrative will be something that you live by, you internalize, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I think one of the things you mentioned in the book actually is that putting pressure on children is asking children to behave like adults, and vice versa, you've got the infantilization of adults. But what did you mean by that? Just for our listeners, so could you just explain what you mean by those ideas?
Well, there's two ideas that I've been developing, and it's still in the process of developing, which is on the one hand, the adultification of children and the infantilization of adults. So these two things go hand in hand. And I think that one of the things that has occurred is that on the one hand, we treat children as like precious little babies that cannot come on the, sort of cope on their own. And we treat them childishly, rather than the way that children ought to be treated. So we don't really trust them to do the kind of things that were expected as normal throughout the centuries. But at the same time, as we're doing that, we often sexualize them. We kind of treat them as like little adults in the way that they're kind of expected to, the way they're, for example, told about psychological issues, and therefore they do become adultified. I remember in my own son, by the time he was 9 or 10, he had a very sophisticated psychological vocabulary that he picked up from school. He would say, "Oh man, I'm really stressed out. I'm depressed." And he sounded like a little Freud because that's what you learn in school, and he'd kind of absorb all these hitherto adult problems. And at the same time, a lot of the adults, because they've, sort of for a variety of reasons, because they become so confused about how to draw the line between themselves and their children, because they're so immersed in their everyday life, begin to act like children. And you have this kind of weird situation where mothers go shopping with their daughters. And it's their daughters tells them what to wear rather than the other way around. And that kind of, shift in generational relationship is quite fascinating from a sociological point of view.
The Sociology Show podcast relies on the kind contributions of sponsorship and donations. If you enjoy the show, then you can help with the hosting costs by donating as little as £5 on the GoFundMe page. Simply visit uk.gofundme.com and search for The Sociology Show. If you can donate, then you will be sent a Sociology Show pen as a small thank you for your continued support of the show.
I was just thinking as well, two decades on from when the book was first published, where do you think we are at the moment, Frank? Do you think the situations have got worse? Have there been improvements? How do you see it?
I think the situation has become far worse, and it's really accelerated, especially in the last decade, and in particular, it's accelerated in relation to the way in which children and their personality has been redefined as one which is inherently powerless and vulnerable, and we don't see completely deny in practice their capacity for resilience. And therefore, we do not believe that children are likely to cope with the kind of normal pressures of everyday life, the existential difficulties that all of us have when we grow up. We see our hurdles that are almost impossible for children to overcome, certainly overcome on their own. And in that sense, what we've done by this kind of parenting regime is we've created a sense of permanent identity crisis, where a lot of young kids are struggling to know who they are, what they're about. Usually, historically, by the time you're 18 or 19, you would have resolved your identity crisis and got a sense of what you're all about. Whereas today, when you're 18 or 19, you still are, in many cases, dealing with issues that historically are pre-adolescent issues.
As I am just thinking about that, as I was looking back over the book, I wondered How important cases such as the Madeleine McCann disappearance or the Manchester bombings, do you think those have had even more impact on the overprotectiveness of parents and sort of overcautiousness about what our children are doing?
To some extent, yes. I mean, you know, the media does play a role, and you know, there are all these symbols of dangers. You know, that one can look back over the 20 years, and there are several cases that highlights the precarious state of childhood. But I think that there is much greater problems than that. I think those amplify rather than are responsible for creating the cultural conditions for these kinds of attitudes. And I think what I see as being a far bigger problem is the loss of confidence in adulthood, the depletion of what it means to be an adult, the moral content of being grown up, of maturity, has been undermined to the extent that a lot of mothers and fathers lack the confidence to be able to do the job. And you know, the tremendous pressure that further undermines that, and they're being continually told that, you know, parenting is the most difficult job you will ever face. That's what they always say, that parenting is the greatest sort of challenge that you will encounter. Whereas for thousands of years, you know, parenting or child rearing was the norm. You didn't need to have a PhD in psychology to be a good mother or father. In fact, you didn't have to go to school at all to be a caring mother and a good father. These things were abilities that evolved with maturity. Whereas today they are, in a sense, called into question, and their importance as a result of that diminishes. Their importance in a sense of you organically becoming a mom and a dad.
Especially when the experts quite often contradict each other, right? There's sort of a minefield of information coming towards parents where they're probably feeling a little bit lost themselves as to what is the correct thing to do in any given situation.
You're right. I mean, that's so confusing because, you know, one day you're told that caring parents sleep with their babies. Next day you're told that if you sleep with your baby, that can create cold death and it's very dangerous. So you're getting, you know, conflicting advice on everything from the food you eat to a variety of other experiences all the time.
And just linking that idea up with your more recent book, How Fear Works, one of the key aspects of that book is that we are experiencing fear differently today than we used to. So do you mind just explaining what you mean by that?
Well, I think that the problem is not fearing, because fearing is a natural, normal state. And sometimes fearing is a good thing because there are some genuine threats out there. I think that the problem that we're faced with is when our understanding of uncertainty becomes one that almost paralyzes us. I mean, historically, uncertainty can be seen as an opportunity, something you kind of look forward to. You don't know what the outcome will be, but you think this is an exciting quest, an exciting adventure. And there are moments in human history where societies really, you know, sort of reveled in that and thrived and flourished on that. And there are times like today when uncertainty is seen not as an opportunity, but as a problem, because we don't think we can manage it. And we become so wary of uncertainty that we end up inflating problems and turning them into threats. But not just turning them into threats, but increasingly into existential threats. So a lot of issues become redefined as the problems of existence. And under those circumstances, the way we fear and the meaning of fear is one that is much more corrosive. It's less helpful than it would be under kind of circumstances. And the book, what I try to do is to try to look at the way that fear works and tries to explain some of the cultural drivers that make us, in a sense, so fearful and lacking in the capacity to manage the uncertain dimensions of our daily lives.
And what would you say are the current main fears that are driving, let's even take it to British society, what are the underlying sort of risk factors people live in fear of?
Well, the interesting thing is that we talk far more about fear than we really fear, because we're encouraged to do that. So I'm involved in a project at the moment where we're looking at what people fear in different parts of Europe. And the interesting thing is that when you look at all the surveys that are being carried out, what people fear are not the headline fears that are from the media. It's not like global terrorism or global warming, or it's not like, you know, sort of pedophilia or, you know, sort of or crime. What people fear at the end of the day is what they've always feared in modern times, particularly from the 20th century onwards, which is their economic security, which is their old age pension, which is the question, you know, is my child going to have a job when they kind of grow up? So what they fear is actually quite constant, and that's the good news. The end of the day, that's what occurs. But the problem is that at the same time, as we kind of have these kinds of fears, we become in a sense inserted into a culture that continually tells us to be anxious, to continually incites us to be fearful, and continually tells us that at the end of the day, we are far less able to deal with many of these problems, many of these threats that they basically presented to us than we imagine. And that's really what I think is particularly damaging. And then that creates sometimes the kind of hysterical or reactions that are not warranted by the kind of threats that we kind of confront.
And if I could make this perhaps a last question then, despite that hysteria, our kind of current capacity to think about, talk about mental health, mental well-being is probably bigger than it's ever been. So is that not working then? If the risk and fear and worry is higher than it's ever been, I'm just working how that balances itself out.
Well, I think here is a very interesting question, because the way that it works, I think, is that, you know, we're often told that we don't talk about mental health enough, and we need to talk about mental health. But it seems to me that all that we ever do at the moment is constantly talk about mental health. Mm-hmm. If you listen to the media or newspapers, and we've basically medicalized everyday life to the point at which that virtually every problem that you will have comes with a psychological diagnosis. You know, you can be shy, but you now have social phobia. If you're a little bit active, you know, sort of in the way that I was when I was a child, then you have attention deficit syndrome of some sort. So there's a variety of different syndromes that attach themselves to just about anything. And I think that what that does is it actually makes us even more disoriented than we already were. And I actually think that the promotion of mental health as a principal problem of our times creates its own demand for mental health intervention. And the more you have counseling facilities available, the more you tell people to come in and tell us about your problems, the more mental health issues are highlighted, the more it actually becomes a public health problem. Mm. And that's the perverse effect, that mental health intervention and the industrialization of mental health is actually turned into a public health problem for which we are responsible. It wasn't the fact that somehow people became, you know, sort of less able to deal with their mental well-being than before. It's a cultural accomplishment which incites us, which reminds us continually that our mental state is in need of repair.
So it's created the fear in itself through the promotion. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Just finally, if people want to find out more about your work, read some of your books, how can they go about that, please?
But there's a number of ways. That I've got a website, frankferredi.com. But probably the most interesting thing that people might find is that I got what's called a Substack. It's called The Roots and Wings, where I write weekly essays on different issues of sociological significance, and which they might want to check out. And of course, if you look on Amazon, my books are there as well. So
great. And they can follow you on Twitter as well?
Absolutely. You can follow me on Twitter, and you know, you can criticize me and react to my my posts.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for having me here.
Thank you.
The Sociology Show podcast relies on the kind contributions of sponsorship and donations. If you enjoy the show, then you can help with the hosting costs by donating as little as £5 on the GoFundMe page. Simply visit uk.gofundme.com and search for The Sociology Show. If you can donate, then you will be sent a Sociology Show pen as a small thank you for your continued support of the show.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to the podcast. If you would like to contact the show or be interviewed, then please email thesociologyshowpodcast@gmail.com.